I'm afraid this is going to be a very non-Germanic approach to this. I have no graphs and no percentages and no nothing. It's a laid-back English impressionistic anecdotal approach to an important subject. When the Siatnik Pyotr Mikhailov set out with the great embassy that left Muscovy in 1697, his desired destination was Holland, and a bit later England came later, and German and Dutch were his languages. His antipathy towards France, which he saw as the supporter of his great enemy, Turkey, he expressed probably in Dutch at his momentous meeting in Utrecht with William III, King of England, seeking the opportunity, he said, of fighting under the banner of England against France, the common destroyer of the liberties of Europe. His knowledge of English, despite his subsequent 100-day sojourn in England at the invitation of the king, never seems to have extended beyond a few words. Confined to the world of shipbuilding, and I guess to the world of drinking and carousing. And back home, although enjoying the company of British shipbuilders and mariners, it was in languages other than English that he spoke with them. If English did not assert itself at such a propitious time, it was doomed to remain a minor language in Russia. Following the rupture of diplomatic relations with Britain in 1716 and Peter's subsequent exposure to the allure of France and all things French during his second expedition. It was German, however, the language of the Baltic states, whence emerged the Empress Anna Ivanovna, Duchess of Courland, that was dominant in the 1730s during the period of Bironishchina at the Russian court. However, when the Noble Land Cadet Corps, which had been founded in 1731, relinquished German in favour of French as its main teaching language early in the reign of Elizabeth, it was an indication that the game was clearly up. It was during Elizabeth's reign that even a French diplomat was amazed at the nuée de français de toute couleur that he found at the Russian court. The march of French was inexorable, unaffected by the ups and downs of diplomatic relations and infiltrating into every aspect of aristocratic culture in the capitals and spreading its tentacles into provincial gentry life. This remained obviously even truer for the reign of Catherine the Great, when, in the words of Denis Diderot, there was aucune nation d'Europe qui se francise plus rapidement que la Russe, et pour la langue et pour les usages. Paradoxically, Catherine's was also the reign when the British enjoyed the halcyon days of their influence in 18th century Russia. In 1769, 4 years after Diderot's pronouncement, Lord Cathcart, the influential British ambassador in Russia, had informed his government that Russia is now, by the Empress's firm, determined, and declared opinions, and will be more so by all her institutions, decidedly English. In the event, she was less decidedly English in her institutions than in her aesthetic taste. These embrace her admiration for the English landscape garden, encapsulated in her confession that to Voltaire, that j'aime à la folie, présentement les jardins à l'anglaise, adding that l'anglomanie domine ma plantomanie, and included her liking, of course, for English literature, leading to her so-called imitations of Shakespeare. Nikolai Nabokov, overreacting to a visit of a company of English actors to St. Petersburg, asserted at about the same time, in 1772, that The French have been replaced by the English. Now men and women are falling over themselves to adopt something from the English. Everything English now seems to us good, charming, and everything enchants us. And over 25 years later, Vasily Malinovsky, who was to become head of the Sastre Lyceum, noted that Russians, our countrymen, who for a century have continually adopted everything from others, have also adopted the general fashion to be à l'anglaise. Even the British did not demur. A Cambridge don declaring with a pronounced dose of superiority that whatever they, the Russians, possess, useful or estimable, comes to them from England. Books, maps, prints, furniture, clothing, hardware of every kind, horses, carriages, hats, leather, medicine, almost every article of convenience, comfort or luxury must be derived from England or it has no consequence. However, while these opinions emphasized the material, the consumer appeal, it was not an era of Anglomania, rather of Anglophilia, a more reasoned appreciation, if not free from idealism, of what Britain offered, that was expressed particularly in the letters and accounts of the increasing numbers of Russians who saw the country with their own eyes during their visits as tourists or in other capacities. How did any or all of this affect the position of the English language? Example from above may well have influenced or encouraged the capital's elite to follow the fashion for English literature, English gardens, English products of different sorts. But the Empress did not give the lead linguistically. As Grand Duchess, she had been encouraged to study the English language by the then British ambassador, who even promised her a copy of Dr. Johnson's famous dictionary. But as Empress, she made no significant progress. Some years ago, investigating the extent of her knowledge of English, I arrived finally at the convoluted formula that she was a German princess who read English works in French and German translations, but who knew enough English to read the occasional page, who never spoke the language, but understood something of what sometimes was said to her in English. Her enthusiasm for England was, of course, always expressed in French. The same held true for most of the notable Anglophiles of the period, especially those of the Turin aristocracy and nobility, who communicated with their British counterparts in French, or like Karamzin, were embarrassed by their attempts to speak English. One of the most glaring examples of the gap between intellectual and emotional sympathies and linguistic incompetence is provided by the Russian ambassador in London, the famous Count Simeon Vorontsov, who spent nearly 50 years in England and always spoke French and always used French as the medium of his intercourse with the cream of English society. A good knowledge of English at this period was to be found predominantly among the young students, apprentices, agriculturalists, embassy officials, and church servants who were thrown in the deep end and during their often prolonged stays in Britain perforce learned English. It was precisely from among the men who had served at the embassy church in London, the so-called Cerkovniki, that there came the first English dictionaries and grammars for the edification of their fellow countrymen. Mikhail Kerensky, on his return to Russia, was soon appointed a teacher of English at the Naval Cadet Corps in Petersburg and produced in 1766 his Angliskaya Grammatika. Historically significant as the first English grammar published in Russia, but of very limited use. More successful was the Angliska Grammatica, published in 1772 and reissued in 1801 by Piontsky's successor in the naval corps, Prokhor Zhdanov, who, in addition to the grammar, included a listing of some 3,000 words, making it the first English-Russian dictionary. It was to be superseded in 1784 by Zhdanov's new dictionary, English and Russian, a huge work of some 750 pages that was dedicated to his pupils at the corps and called on them to use their knowledge of English to translate into Russian, and I quote, all the best works in which England, more than any other country, abounds. The English-speaking cadets of the Naval Corps were joined as carriers of the English tongue by the groups of midshipmen who had learnt English out of necessity, serving in the British Navy, and who on their return frequently served on Russian ships commanded by British officers who were recruited in significant numbers into Catherine's Navy in the Baltic and in the Black Sea. And not unusually, they acted as their interpreters. And if there was one place in Russia where English jostled Russian as the lingua franca, that was Kronstadt, the fortress city essentially constructed by a Welshman in Peter's time and strengthened by a Scot in Catherine's. It was to Kronstadt that the Naval College transferred in 1783, and the tradition of teaching English and of English as the language of communication in some classes that were taught by English instructors continued to flourish. There was even a Masonic lodge, the Neptune, where members were principally British or English-speaking Russian naval officers. Kronstadt was both the home of the Russian Baltic Fleet and a trading hub, its commercial harbour receiving an unending stream of British ships, bringing in those indispensable British goods for the Russian market. Here, British sailors mixed with British merchants and drank in the English pub and visited occasionally the English church. Numerous visitors to Kronstadt before transferring into smaller boats before transfer to the capital remarked on the babble of English voices and thought they were all in an English port. I quote, every second person we saw was English. The beach, quays, streets and taverns, their keepers and servants, also of the same nation, were crowded with them, bustling to and fro with a characteristic hurry of commercial business, and occasionally, it must be confessed, dealing with each other and to strangers, unluckily in their way, some of the choicest flowers of nautical eloquence. This is not an occasional, but on the contrary, a constant scene, all the months in which, from the absence of the ice, the Gulf of Finland is open to traders, so that we might be taken here for an English colony. Goods were transferred to St. Petersburg, to the Gostiny Dvor, near the Spit on Vasilievsky, Ostrov, up the Little Neva. And here the British traders, united under the name of the British Factory, had an office and warehouses. Alexander Radishev, appointed to the Petersburg Customs House in 1780, soon discovered that although he had a complete command of French and German, it was English he had to learn in order to carry out his work satisfactorily. There were indeed a lot of British, as you know, in Catherine's Petersburg, and its most affluent representatives occupied imposing houses along the British English embankment, where the English church stood. The colony may well have been 1,500 strong in Catherine's reign, but these were really mere drops in the ocean and linguistically not making much impact outside their own intimate circles. In the Masonic Lodge, Perfect Union, erected in 1771, which prided itself very much on being English, the languages were German and French. In fact, its orator was a Frenchman. And the famous English club, founded the previous year, seemingly never tried to impose English. And as its popularity grew during the reigns of Alexander I and Nicholas I, British-born members became fewer and fewer, and Russian and French dominated. Now, we have some evidence of attempts to sell English as an attractive addition to the linguistic armoury of well-bred Russians. In 1792, a certain John Elmore set up a school on Vasilievsky Island at which children of both sexes will be taught in English reading, writing and arithmetic, meant for both resident British and Russians, one suspects. But of his success, or probable lack of it, we have no further indication. These were the years when the British were advertising their skills not only as grooms and coachmen, blacksmiths and gardeners, but also as valets, tutors, governesses and nannies. We read, for instance, in the Encyclopedia of Vedomosti, of an Englishman having sound knowledge of his native language and also experienced in the education of children, wishes to become a teacher of English and basic arithmetic in a noble family, while a Mrs. Lake made known her willingness to teach British Bible history in English to a noble young lady. It's striking, however, that it is their ability to speak French and German that many British emphasise when they offer their services as valets or companions. Probably just as well, when we read that, I quote, "In summer I bees clerk to a butcher in Kronstadt, and in winter I teaches English to the Russian nobility's children." Words carefully recorded in the journal of a traveller early in the next century. There was, nevertheless, an interesting development later in Catherine's reign that established a tradition within the imperial family, lasting until the October Revolution, of appointing British nannies and governesses for the infant and young Grand Dukes and Duchesses. Alexander, Constantine and Nicholas, the sons of Paul I, all had Scottish nannies. Referring to Pauline Gessler, whose sister was, Scottish sister, was Constantine's nanny, Catherine the Great said in March 1793, just months before Alexander's wedding, that should he have a son who was to be brought up for 7 years by a similar English woman, then the imperial line would be assured for 100 years. Nicholas's nanny was the famous Nyanya Levitsa, Jenny Lyons, who remained with the imperial family way into the 1830s. The English chaplain, the splendidly named Reverend London King Pitt, taught English to Alexander's consort, Elizaveta Alexeyevna, and knowledge and use of English within the imperial family was widespread in the 19th century, reaching perhaps its peak with Nicholas II and Alexandra and their children, when English was often their favoured language of communication. The imperial example spread to many aristocratic families. Protasova, one of Catherine's most noted ladies-in-waiting, had an English governess, whose son James Grange was incidentally Alexander's childhood playmate. A family near to the court, and particularly distinguished by its English sympathies, was that of the Goffmeister Pyotr Lvovich Davidov and his wife, daughter of Vladimir Arlov, of whom it was said that he's a lover of the English, and so were all the Arlovs. The Davidovs had an English governess, for instance, a Miss Hastily from Coventry for their children, one of whom was Vladimir Petrovich, who was to graduate from Edinburgh University. As a final example from the very many that could be adduced of governesses and nannies, the governess of Countess Shuvalova was the widowed Elizabeth Stevens, whose elder daughter, also Elizabeth, was to marry none other than Mikhail Speransky, but to die tragically in childbirth a year later, never having spoken the language of word in English between them, actually. Examples of Anglo-Russian marriages were not infrequent during the reigns of Catherine and Alexander, and arose as a result of meetings in England during their service there, notable examples of Admirals Matvinov and Chichagov, prominent figures in Alexander's reign, or indeed in Russia with members of the resident British community. One of the most English of households in Petersburg during the 1790s, with open house for both visiting British and Anglophile Russians alike, was that of the Reverend Andrei Samborsky, the remarkable priest who during his long years at the British Church, at the Russian Church in London, had married an English woman. there is testimony, somewhat conflicting, to the relative positions of English and Russian during Alexander's reign. There is little doubt that English was making headway, and there was to, and that to acquire it, or at least a smattering, was not without its own hint of the snob, to use but one of the many English words that enlivened the conversations of the Alexandrine salon. Despite the difficulties at the end of Paul's reign and the forthcoming considerable but short-lived blip occasioned by the Treaty of Tilsit, the beautiful beginnings of Alexandrine days brought heady times for the British, their culture and their language. The Tsar's own intimate group, the Young Friends, were all dubbed Anglomaniacs by the memoirist Philippe Vigil, who declared that England was our patroness, Anglia была наша патронша. It was precisely at this time that the word Anglomaniac made its first appearance in a Russian dictionary, in Yanovsky's Novy Slovo Tolkovachi, when it is defined as a person who is astonished by and imitates to ludicrous excess everything that's done in England. Anglomaniacs obviously existed in life, but as yet they made but rare appearances in literature. The invariable target of the late 18th century, early 19th century Russian satirical journals and comedies were either those Russians who aped the French or the French who misled and deceived them. It was necessary to wait for Pushkin, Gogol and Dostoevsky for the first real depictions. But it was literature, English literature, that was, if anything, the true cause of the mania, as Russians, having passed through the craze for the English novel, particularly for Gothic romances a la Radcliffe, fell under the spell of the works of Byron and Sir Walter Scott, and indeed Shakespeare. It was English literature, read by many in translation, be it Russian, French or German, that not only fired the imagination with images of British settings and British heroes and heroines, but more significantly inspired many to learn the language. It was Griboyedov who said to Ctesiphont Palivoy that one should be ashamed to read Shakespeare in translation. If one really wants to understand him, for like all the great poets, he is untranslatable because he is national, you should learn English as a matter of urgency, which incidentally Palevoy did. The list of eminent Russian writers, poets, journalists who studied the language at this time is truly long and impressive. If from an earlier generation we cite the names of Karamzin, Zhukovsky, Bobrov and Bartoshkov, then Pushkin's generation, with him in the van, includes such people as Kozlov, Vyazemsky, Gestuzov, Malinsky, Chatayev, the Turgenev brothers, and a whole host of descendants. A number of learning aids, grammars, dictionaries and the like, appeared in the first decade of the 19th century, and it's a matter of note that with the exception of the unfinished Slovar Rossiyskoe Anglinsky, 1808-13, compiled by Ivan Shushurin, Shishukov, yet another instructor at the Naval Cadet Corps. They were all published in Moscow. Vasily Priazhev, author of several aids in the 1790s, and the Novy Praktichesky Razgovory Anglisky in 1811, was director of a pension attached to Moscow University. And it was at the university that Gruzinov, author of an Anglisky Grammatica, taught. English teaching at Moscow University was for many years in the hands of Thomas Evans, who had arrived in England in Russia in 1804 and remained until his death in 1848. It was in Moscow that John Banks began in 1814 and finished in 1824 his large two-volume Anglisky Rossiyskoe Slovar, which was published only in 1838, but superseded all its predecessors and was generally acclaimed. A final interesting indication of the perceived interest in Moscow in English language and literature was the publication at the very beginning of 1823 of a monthly English literary journal of Moscow, intended to meet, and I quote, The marked attention now paid throughout Europe, but particularly in Russia, to the study of the language of England. It survived in mere 5 issues. Not quite as long as the slightly more successful Nevsky journal, published 4 decades later in St. Petersburg. I'm finishing. The title of my paper was framed, as we emphasized, as a question. The answer to it was fairly obvious from the outset. No, English did not seriously challenge French as the dominant foreign language during Alexander's reign. But its status as what we might call the thinking man's language, the Yazyk Intelligente, was immeasurably raised. Sadly, the English language was not able to join fully in the Allies' triumph over Napoleon. The Allied officers communicated in French, and the Russian officers occupying Paris were enchanted by French salon culture and the French language. Pushkin, in his unfinished Roslavyev, shows how ingrained French was in Russian society, where Russian ladies were unable to express their patriotic fervor in Russian. If England played a role in freeing Russian society from the stranglehold of French, it was in demonstrating one's pride in one's native language. Russian established itself within Russian society and government, but French remained the language that British diplomats and travellers, not bothering to learn Russian and astonished when they encountered English speakers, needed to communicate with their Russian hosts. Move on a century, and the corresponding blitz of the Boer War and Britain's support for Japan, a new Anglo-Russian treaty ushered in a new feel-good factor that lasted into the final stages of World War I. Although much more widespread among the upper echelons of Russian society, still competed with French and German. It needed another world war and the ensuing decades for English, bolstered by radio and the spread of television, pop music, and the mighty support of America for English and its American variant, to oust French and to become the lingua franca, not of a ruling elite, but of wide sections of the public, particularly its young generation. It was a long, long road before French was last relegated to play second fiddle.